Session number 20983, Reel 4.
Jim Campbell, Reel 4.
Yes. Now then, as I say, this went on day after day. Small attacks, just in small pockets here and there. We're still suffering with casualties as well. And then there was one particular incident where they pulled us back before we sent us back in again. They told us we're going to get a strafing by the typhoons. So we're all agog watching this. We're all lined up on a road ready to follow up when these typhoons come in from behind us and we could watch them. And then we heard what we thought was bells ringing. But it wasn't until we were virtually on top of us we realised what we were hearing. It was the shell casings from 20mm cannon dropping from 300 feet or so, hitting this road, hitting our vehicles, and they were showering us with these empty casings. So you never seen anybody move so quick to get under our vehicles in all their life to get some protection, because if you're hit with one of these, it would kill you from that height. It was the first time we experienced this, so we're always very wary in future when we're close support with these aircraft. However, it did work because we did take our objective the next morning. Then we're pulled out again to prepare for the attack on Tilburg. Now, Tilburg was the first major city or town that we were ever likely to occupy. And we're told then that we were in support of the Dutch Princess Irene Brigade was moving up from France to take this first town. It was more or less an honour for them. But when they got up, the word got round that the town was being held by a battalion of Dutch SS in the German army. And there was some dispute over this, so it was agreed that the 15th Scottish Division should take Tilburg. So after a lot of to and fro, and we got ourselves sorted out, and then they went, 44 Brigade again went in first. We did a sort of flanking movement and come in from the sort of northwest. Anyway, by that time the Germans had pulled out and there was very little firing, thank goodness, because the town was packed solid with civilians. Now, we thought we'd had a tremendous welcome in Belgium, but even the Dutch surpassed this. And it went on for about 24 hours. The number of times they sung the Dutch national anthem was, well, no, I didn't count. You couldn't have counted it. However, we're told then we're going to stop here to rest for a fortnight to recuperate because we've been on the move one way or the other for 100 days. We'd been in action or we'd been in support of the frontline troops. We'd been feeding on army biscuits and compo rations, although we're getting one hot meal a day most days, which is extremely well done by the quartermaster staff. A lot of the time we're just eating cheese and biscuits and tins of bully beef to keep ourselves going. So it was quite a relief when we were told that we were going to stay here in this town and that we've been billeted by Dutch civilians. So we found a family who were very, very good to us. They gave us two rooms and they sort of crammed into one or two and we're all right for the night. However, the next morning, all the NCOs were called for an O group, and when we got to our place of O group, we were told then that there'd been a big attack that had gone in the American flank on the other side of the corridor, and that we were going raced across there to stem this attack. So there went our 14 days leave with exactly 24 hours. So it was a night move right across Holland to what we call the Plein Marshes. Now, it was pitch black all the way up there, and when we got up to where we're supposed to be, of course we had our advance parties up there guiding us in, all we found was one American tank and one American soldier, and we could hardly see him. He was a black man, and apparently he had fallen asleep or something while the rest of them had pulled out. However, we occupied what we thought was the American front line, and then we sent out our patrols to find out what was going on, and we soon found out, all right, we come under fire from nearly every direction in the map. So we started putting in our attacks as well. However, as we moved forward, we're more or less confined to these tracks, and even the paper said it was mud and mines. You couldn't put a shovel into the ground. As soon as you started digging in a slit trench, for example, it just filled up with water. So what we had to do is use the ditches alongside the fields, and they were full of water. So I can tell you it was a most uncomfortable, less acid for about 10 days. And we gradually wore these Germans down and pushed them back and pushed them back, village by village, until such times as we cleared them from the west bank of the Maas and pushed them right across the river. However, our task wasn't finished there. We were then told that because of the state we were in, we weren't fit for frontline action, and we're now going to be put in a holding position for, it must have been October through November, December, January. So for virtually 3 months of that winter, we were 7 days, as we called it, in the front line. I beg your pardon, 10 days in the front line and 7 days out. And we changed with the HLI and the Gordons and ourselves into a sector from Venlo up towards Goch. So we occupied all these villages in the front line from time to time. And although nothing much happened, it was a terribly uncomfortable period. It was the coldest winter reckoned in history in Holland, the winter of 44-45. So every night, or every other night rather, we had to take our turn and go up to the actual, up onto the banks of the river and lay there all night long in listening posts with a telephone at our side, which buzzed during the night. You picked the phone up and blew into it twice and put the phone down again. That signaled to him that everyone was quiet and everyone was okay. So as I say once more, it was nice when you get back again to little villages called Panigan, and we kept coming back to the same house all the time. So we got to know the family quite well. But even then we had our incidents. Even the first night we were there, on the way up, the husband of the house went up to his little plot of ground to get some vegetables and stood on a mine and got killed. So that wasn't very pleasant. And during the time we were up there, although we were on the front line, we heard the explosion, and I believe it was the King's Own Scottish Borderers were loading ammunition onto the back of a 1500-watt truck. And it was pea ammunition, and somebody hadn't put the safety cap back on, and one of these bombs exploded and blew the whole truckload of ammunition up and killed a number of young children that had been watching these troops operating. So we kept getting these sad stories coming through all the time, you know, people being killed so unnecessarily. So by the time January came, we were glad to get back out of that area, I don't mind telling you. And we then pulled back way down to a place, I think it was Roermond or Maastricht, and then we were given our role again, we're pulled back down to Tilburg, that's what it was, to be reinforced and rested. So we went back into amongst an area which we knew, although we were out in the field, were just some slit trenches with head cover. And up came our reinforcements, new vehicles, all equipped with Bren gun cars, Canadian Brens, and they took the Carn Lloyd carriers off us, which were good enough vehicle, but they were flimsy, the sides of them were just tin. So we're quite happy to get these Carn Lloyd carriers, two to each gun, one to carry ammunition, one to pull the gun and its stores and crew. So we started our training after that for the attack on at Nijmegen to clear up between the west bank of the Maas and the Rhine. So after a lot of rest and recuperation, as I say, we then moved up to Nijmegen and were billeted in a school. Now, this was done in the darkness, by the way. We weren't allowed to expose ourselves in daylight. There were quite a build-up here. And then on the briefing, we were rather surprised that they still had a number of troops left that they had. And we're told that the attack would start on such and such a date, that the 15th Scottish Division would spearhead the attack. Now, on this briefing, we're told we're coming under command of the Canadian Army, and there would be two Canadian divisions on our left and two British divisions on our right, which was the 43rd Division, and I believe it was the 53rd Welsh, supported by the 51st Division, the 11th Armoured Division, and all sorts of other armoured division as well. And how they were going to operate was like a football team. So they showed us on the map exactly what's going to happen, and we were given the honour, if you could call it that, of leading the actual attack. The HLI on the left, or our left rather, with the Argylls up front as well. So our first objective was a place called Cranenburg, which is a railway junction just over the German border, and this is the first time we'd actually occupied German territory. And the attack went extremely well right up until that point. And it wasn't in until we started the second attack that we did were casualties. Now, on this attack as well, as I told you, there was five divisions all moving virtually at once. But I think I'm right in saying with the biggest artillery barrage of the war, there was 1,300 guns firing on this particular attack. And where the HLI and myself were going in first, it was like a scene from the 1418 war where we never practiced them very much. But what we did do was rely on our forward observation officers from the artillery to keep control. And we're told exactly what's going to happen, that to when to move and when not to move. And they finally shoot us right onto our objective. Now, the second phase of the attack was quite good until such times the Germans started flooding the battlefield. And we finished up wading through water up to at least our waist level until we got onto the higher ground, which is our objective. And they've shot us right onto that. And although we had several casualties, most of it was from our own artillery falling short rather than from the enemy artillery, and quite a few casualties with mines. But having got onto our objective and bang on time as well, we're virtually overlooking the battlefield. And from there on in, that attack went in most successfully. And everybody said this, without the 15th Scottish Division effort taking that initial hill, they'd been all, would have taken it, but the casualties would have been pretty heavy altogether. And from there on in, it was a case of the 51st get the credit for clearing the Rupall Forest. We cracked the Siegfried Line. We turned left to take Cleve and Goch, two major German cities that had been very, very badly bombed two nights previously. So there were all sorts of activities here, and it's the first time we also put an attack in with what we call kangaroos. Now, these were Canadian ram tanks with the guns taken out of them and infantry put inside the tank as armoured personnel carriers. We went in along with infantry. We were six-pounders hooked on the back, and we put in two of these attacks most successfully with just a screen of fighting tanks around us with maybe 100 tanks in the centre. And we just poured into these German positions, leapt out the tanks, and the Germans just gave themselves up. I mean, they're just sheer mass, sheer weight of numbers just overpowered them. And we were highly delighted, of course. We took hundreds of prisoners and without any casualties. We then kept going down there, although we did start going down on our feet again, and that's when we started taking our casualties again, down to a place called Udom, where we get badly shelled, badly mortared. And then a little place called Xanten, X-A-N-T-E-N, which again would appear in the story later on. And having said that, we then made contact with the Americans on our right, and as far as we're concerned, that was the battle of the clearing of the mass, between the mass and the Rhine anyway. So we then pulled back out again, back down to Maastricht and Roermond, to start preparing for the crossing of the Rhine. Okay. Now then.
Other incidents that happened to you at the Reichswald that you should explain?
Again, it was over so quickly. Again, all we can say is the praise for our artillery. I mean, I know it was General Montgomery's great weapon, artillery fire, to subdue these German positions. All credit to him, because they never let us down. Yes, there was an incident, actually, I must say. Okay, we're talking about artillery again, and this came to mind. It was during one of these places, at times when whether we were in the wrong place at the wrong time, or whether the artillery got their coordinates wrong, but twice we were shelled by our own artillery and inflicted quite a number of casualties on us, particularly a very good friend of mine from the carrier platoon, Sergeant Stevenson. He got hit very badly, and we loaded one of my carriers to take him away, and unfortunately he died in the hospital. But we had quite a few killed that day as well. And until such times as we got that artillery fire stopped, we had no idea who it was, but the air was blue with swear words from the commanding officer. And again, it seemed to come at the end of the attack. You know, the war was virtually finished. Well, that particular part of the war was virtually finished when this happened. And then, as I say, that's the only incident, but I must say, to see the way the army performed in that particular attack, to see five divisions moving all at once. He didn't see all of it, but he saw most of it and heard the radio reports, because by this time, you know, we had good contact and we knew exactly what was going on. Virtually every objective was taken on time with minimum casualties. Good heavens, it's 11:45. Change this last period. So, on we go to the Rhine crossing.
Please.
Now, having did an exercise on the mass, we did one by daylight and one at night time, and we're introduced to a thing called a buffalo. Now, the buffalo was a track vehicle, rather tall. The tail fell down, so you could load a carrier or a 1,500-watt truck or a 6-pounder anti-tank gun, as it was, aboard that thing. And when they closed up the back of it, it sealed it in. Now, it could run on the road on tracks, or it convert to waterborne, and you had about 12 inches of freeboard, that was all when it was loaded. But the tracks also acted as paddles, and this is what we were to cross the Rhine on. We also had these ducks, but we didn't see much of them, which could run in wheels on the road, ran into the water and then switched over onto propeller power. So the preparation for this was quite intense. Plenty of briefing, plenty of photographs, plenty of sand models of what we had to do. But, as the old bard said, the best laid schemes of mice and men gang off a glee. Come the time, we then moved up virtually to the banks of the Rhine. And for about 3 days, these big smoke, for the want of a better word, they looked like 240-gallon drums standing top of one, producing masses and masses of smoke. So we're under smoke all day in woods, and we're coughing and spluttering. Sometimes we even had to put our gas masks on to try and get some relief from this. And as the build-up came, you know, ammunition was getting stacked and bridging materials were getting stacked, and we saw a convoy of low loaders coming up with barges on it. And lo and behold, there was sailors on top of these barges giving hand signals, semaphore, on the way up. But these were actually helping to build a bridge across the Rhine. So we knew this was going to happen. And they actually had a small tugboat on one of these low loaders as well to maneuver these barges into position. So it was quite an exciting time. So the build-up went like this. We then were told that we're going to cross at 1 o'clock or 1:30 in the morning. But the 51st Division on our left would go for a town called Wesel, and the Commando Brigade on our right would go for a town called Ries, which was on the what we might call the German bank, the German side of the river, and that we would cross at 1:30 in the morning. Well, you can well imagine the Germans are well alerted by the time we crossed. So by the time we got into our buffalo, ran down the banks into the river, the artificial moonlight going, which is searchlight shining onto the cloud base and reflecting back down on the water. Well, all you could hear was people shouting, turn these so-and-so lights out, because we felt as though we're silhouetted on the river. If we could see, I know, 100, 200, 300 yards up river and down river, so the Germans could see us sitting out in the middle there like ducks. So there was quite a bit of machine gun fire from the German side of the bank. And although we had 0.5 Brownings mounted on these buffalo, we were only too glad to get into the river and across the other side. Now, my vehicle, my Bren gun carrier, was to my right. I could see him up the river. And as we hit the bank, we could see him climbing all right. And as we hit the bank, we didn't make it the first time. So the reverse back down in the river, and the current being quite strong as it was, it washes a wee bit downstream. So by the time he had hit the bank again and we managed to get up this time, there were quite a few yards separated me from my carrier. Lo and behold, when he got off the water, it was absolutely pitch black. So I had to then go looking for my carrier. And my driver was, his name was Bud Fisher, came from Falkirk. His regimental number was 299-0000, and as he called himself, he was the last of their guiles. Because our numbers were 297, 298, 299. So anyway, having found Buds, and we then had to sort of get bodies out of the way, all the infantry were lying down, sort of, and I said, look, there's a carrier coming through. out of the way. So we eventually linked up with my gun. I then had to go and find my company commander, Major Graham, C Company, reported to him that we were ready. Any orders? He said, no, just keep your eye on me. So it was the normal form. He just kept your eye, and we told him where we would be to his right and rear. And there was a big bund there, you know, for the flood dikes. And the engineers blew that, only they didn't tell us. And the next thing, we get showered with this earth off this bund. You know, and we said, thank you very much. There was quite a bit of firing going on, Spandau's, you know, close proximity. But it wasn't until the next day that we found out we'd ran right into a brigade of the Hermann Göring Parachute Division. Now, we had no idea that they were in the area, and they were tough troops, believe you me. They hadn't seen much of the war. They'd been held in reserve, sort of style. And it's the first time I think they'd been in action for some considerable time. So therefore, they put up a tremendous amount of resistance, and they created quite a number of casualties. In fact, we had 31 killed that morning in our battalion alone. So goodness knows what the rest of the division suffered. They must have been all much the same. So it was virtually close quarter fighting. We had tanks swam across with us, although I didn't see them at the time. But when daylight came, we could see them stuck behind houses here and there. And as I say, it was a case of just taking one farmhouse at a time, advancing behind smoke screens. But there was one incident that morning when the company commander, you know, I was lying on top of the bund, when the company commander waved us forward and he said, I'd like a six-pounder over here, and told us where to go. We no sooner got ourselves into position, we got our camouflage net up, and the next minute a shell landed about 10 yards in front of us, showered us with earth, shrapnel. The tree that we were hiding under was virtually shredded. The next thing, the company commander was telling us to get the hell out of that again. So to hook up the gun and disappear back over this great big bund. And so this is how it went on all day long. Stop, start, move here, move there, until we finally cleared our area. And it took us some considerable time. Because of the situation, the battalion gets split in two. And there were lakes, you could call them, or floodplains in between, which had been flooded, and it split the battalion up. So it was just a case of each company commander doing what he could do until such times as we reached the other side and got on with objectives. And by this time, of course, the commanding officers run the spot with temper, you know, because of the hold up, this, that, the next thing. But eventually we got there, and then the next thing we heard that the 6th Airborne Division was coming over, everyone had to stop firing at 10 o'clock. So at 10 o'clock, overcame the airborne again. Now, whether it was, we knew it was the 6th Airborne, and they were right, we could see the Americans. And we were actually waving at the guys standing in the door. So we had a grandstand view of the 6th Airborne Division coming over the top of us, and we could actually see them leaving the aircraft about 5 mile ahead of us, and then circling away. And we, of course, had a tremendous amount of fighter aircraft all around them. And then we looked over the river, and we could see then the Navy in action with this tug pulling these big pontoons into position. And by, I think they started about 10 o'clock in the morning, about the same time as Airborne. Well, I'm not sure when they started, but I think they had the bridge completed at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And we actually saw the armoured coming across the river. It was a tremendous feat of engineering to watch that happening, because the river must have been about 400 metres wide at that area. And a very, very fast current. It must have been 4 or 5 knots. So again, the Battle of the Rhine wasn't quite over for us. At 4:30 in the afternoon, we heard we made contact with the 6th Airborne. And later on that night, we'd squeezed these Germans in between us. And although they were putting up quite a bit of resistance here and there, we had to be very careful what was happening, because we then ran into our own troops. So having made contact, we then sorted it all out, stayed there the night in these woods, had a briefing to tell us what was happening. And then we crossed over with the airborne on our right, us to the left, and then started our advance across Germany. I think the first big city or big town we took was Osnabrück. Now, there we ran into an American armor division, and they were looking for something to do. So we says, fine, support us. So we loaded our infantry aboard these tanks and more or less shot our way through Osnabrück. Although there was very little opposition, and most of the town was in fire anyway, I think it had been pretty heavily bombed. Having got through Osnabrück, the Americans said, right, we'll need to stop here, and we've been recalled. So we're left on our foot again. So we kept going on foot as far as we could go. And then the next town we took was Minden. Now, that is quite a name, Minden, in the history. And the King's Own Scottish Borderers, who had actually been at the Battle of Minden away back years and years ago, actually stuck roses in their steel helmets as they marched through the town. So that was quite an event. So having taken Minden, I then moved up to the next big town, which was Celle, C-E-L-L-E. Now, we ran overran an airfield there. And when they say an airfield, most of it was underground. They'd been very clever, the Germans. They built their hangars, and then they'd piled earth all over the top of it with trees on top of that, so it was perfectly camouflaged. And it wasn't until we got up there we started finding the Germans. First time we'd ever seen the German jets. We hadn't seen them in flight yet. Well, I beg your pardon, we did see them in flight. Christmas Day, when we're up on the mass, the Germans put in a strong attack against Eindhoven airfield and virtually wrote off the 2nd Tactical Air Force with these jet fighter bombers of theirs. And of course we had no idea what it was. The ACAC had no idea what it was. They couldn't even keep up with them. They couldn't pivot their guns quick enough. Anyway, this is the first time we'd actually seen them close up on the ground, although we're to see them later on. However, when we got to Celle, we had quite a funny incident with people with different coloured torches waved us through the town. And it wasn't until we got up to him we found out it was German military police actually waving us through the town. They had no idea it was British troops. So we quickly put them in the bag and virtually captured the garrison. Coming out of their beds. They had no idea that British troops were so close. That's how bad their communications were. We thought ours was bad. So anyway, having got up to I think it was the Aller, the river that runs through Celle, we found a bridge intact. Although it was a wooden bridge. So we reckoned this, I know our engineers were up there along with us. The engineers went across and said it would be safe to take one vehicle at a time. So you can imagine us in a Bren gun carrier with a 2,500-foot gun behind us creeping across this bridge, and it was creaking and cracking and swaying. But eventually all the battalion transport got over it. Unfortunately, the first tank that tried to cross it, the whole damn thing collapsed into the river and they dropped about 30 feet with quite a splash. So it meant then we had to sort of delay our move until such times as they got a bridge built to take the rest of the armour division. However, we kept moving, and it wasn't until we got up to the next big town called Ulsen that we ran into opposition, and believe you me, it was opposition. We were then on to Lüneburg Heath, and there the Germans had an artillery, anti-tank artillery school, as well as an ACAC training area, and the 10th HLI, along with our M10s of our own regiment, actually, the 93rd, I think it was, anti-tank regiment, and a sprinkling of tanks ran into an ambush and got badly shot up by these German instructors and fanatical cadets that they were manning these weapons. So what they did was they stopped there and then, and we come under attack then under fire from multi-barreled ACAC weapons, you know, these 20mm things, and believe you me, they could put up quite a rate of fire. And it wasn't bad enough in machine guns firing at you, but when you had these things whistling through and crackling, there were very little cover, so we suffered quite a lot of casualties there. And then somebody had a brilliant idea. Apparently they captured a couple of Germans who were only too pleased to guide us. And we then took to paths through the forest and we encircled Ulsen. So we drive right through this German forest, pitch black across Lüneburg Heath. We had no idea what we were going to run into. We had a squadron of tanks in front of us, about maybe 12 of them. I was in the leading six-pounder behind a rifle company who was close up to the tanks. And we went screaming through this forest. It must have taken us about 8 hours at least, steady driving, until we come round the back of Ulsen in the daylight by that time. And of course, what happened was that the Germans said it was full of hospitals, but as it turned out, they'd painted nearly every building in the town with red crosses so it wouldn't be bombed. But as it turned out, we had quite a lot of prisoners in there, wounded prisoners, as well as a prisoner of war camp. So we're only too pleased to release these guys, you know, British and American. So there were quite a bit of celebration there and stories we exchanged. And then they said, righto, we're last leg up to the Elbe. So then got aboard our vehicles again And we're leapfrogging all the time. Sometimes we're marching, sometimes we were on TCVs, as we called it, troop carrying vehicles. Most of the times, I say, we're on our flat feet. But the Germans kept mining the roads and blowing up bridges, and there were hold-ups all the time. And then we'd get our, what we called the funnies up with the fascines, which was a great big sort of 8-foot roll of timber in front of the tank, which you'd drop it in a ditch and drive over it like a bridge. Or a bridge which was like a caliper, it would open up and drop across these big holes in the road or these ditches and drive over the top of it. We also had, amongst them, we'd only ever seen them in action once, the bombards, which was a sort of